Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving to you and to all of our listeners out there who are listening to this while they're cooking their turkey. Are you having a big Thanksgiving feast there in Virginia, Frank?
Well, not huge. We're going to some friend's house, and my sister-in-law is visiting us from Sweden, and she's never had Thanksgiving in the United States, so she's very, very excited. So we're going to go to some friends tomorrow, and that's quite good. She celebrated Thanksgiving with us in Edinburgh, but that's obviously not quite the same. So this is her.
A real American Thanksgiving, yes.
Exactly. So this is my first Thanksgiving in the United States for probably, 27 years, 26 years.
Oh, wow. It's exciting. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have not had a chance to have an episode for a little bit because of some travel you've been doing and some illness I've been having. So we wanted to tackle two big issues this week. One is a follow-up in some ways to our last episode where we made some predictions about the midterms and wanted to talk about see how well we did in our predictions. And the second thing we'd like to talk about is an interview with a really renowned historian, one of the sort of premier historians practicing in the United States right now, Jill Lepore, who has a new book that just came out called These Truths, A History of the United States. And she had a very interesting interview, albeit somewhat controversial interview in the Chronicle of Higher Education, where she talks about not only that book, but about academia more broadly and how history is practiced and how history works in the public sphere. So we wanted to react to some of the things that she says in that interview. So Frank, how good going back to the midterms? How did we do in our predictions about the midterms?
I think we did okay, actually.
Okay, good.
That's it. We can move on to Jill Lepore now. No. I mean, I think, and in fact, I this is the first chance I've had to talk to you since then, David. And I did. I have thought about you a lot over the past 2 weeks, wondering how how your mood's been, because you tend to be more pessimistic than me. And I will give you time to rebut this in a moment. And the initial response to the election results was sort of tepid. People said it wasn't a blue wave, but I think as the results have additional results have poured in, I think it was a pretty good night for the Democrats, and I they're heading towards a majority of between 35 and 40 in the House. Mm-hmm. Republicans were wiped out in places like Orange County, California, which of course gave us Richard Nixon and was a hotbed for Reaganism. I think there's only one Republican congressman left in New Jersey. There are no congressmen or women for the Republican Party in all of New England, and Susan Collins is the lone Republican senator from New England, and I think she's in danger in 2 years' time. So all told, I think it was pretty good. I think the Democrats lost a lot of the high-profile races. So Beto O'Rourke lost, albeit only by 2.6% in Texas. The Democrats, Andrew Gillum, lost in Florida, and Stacey Abrams lost in Georgia, although I have a feeling we might have something to say about Georgia. Mm. I think the initial response was somewhat muted because the Democrats, the high-profile Democrats, seemed to lose on the night. But I think if we take a look back and look at the results in a kind of global picture, it was a pretty good night. And that's pretty much what we predicted. We predicted the Democrats would win the House but not win the Senate, and that's what's happened. The Democrats have won the House by a pretty substantial margin, actually. Mm. And I think if you consider President Trump's response to this, which was the day after the election, he gave that very bizarre press conference, and now he's withdrawn into what I think the press called a cocoon of misery. I think he's bothered by these results, which is the most telling aspect of all. So, David, I guess I'd ask you what you think. But first, were you kind of down in the beginning, and have you recovered, or did I misread you?
So I think the results were sort of as I expected them to be. So I wasn't you know, like in the Texas race and other things, I my hopes were not high that Ted Cruz would be leaving the Senate. So the results, I think, were as I expected. In terms of trying to place this election into some kind of historical context, there's a couple of things that jumped out at me. One is the new Congress is going to be the most diverse Congress
ever
we've ever seen. There'll be more women in it. There'll be more minorities in it. There'll be more not only racial minorities, but LGBT minorities. There'll be more Muslims in Congress. So just the diversity, the way in which Congress represents the population, it'll be much more representative than it ever has been. Of course, all of that is on the almost all of that is on the Democratic side of the House. So the Democrats have sent a contingent of, especially some new politicians, new people who are relatively neophytes in the political sphere to Washington, that really do represent a new sort of generation, a new look, and I think that's really historically going to be very important. To be sure, both the House and the Senate are still overwhelmingly white and they're still overwhelmingly male, but we're getting closer to a point of equity and representation. So I think that's interesting and important. The story about the midterms that I think has not really been talked about much, and one that I think is going to have a lasting impact, is this is, I think, an election where the referenda mattered a great deal. And I think that's gotten less attention maybe than the purely partisan races. Because one of the things that's happening, I think one of the things that this election has shown is there's a very split political divide in the country. But if you look at the referendum, actually, so there's lots of very progressive issues that got passed by the voters in some places we think of as being traditionally red states. So we've got Medicaid expansion in Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah. Only one state turned down a Medicaid expansion.
Yes, if you take Barack Obama's name off it, people want health care.
The minimum wage got raised in Arkansas and Missouri. We have marijuana legalization in Michigan, medical marijuana in Utah and Missouri. I guess that goes along with the minimum wage, interestingly.
who knows? Enfranchisement of former felons in Florida.
Well, that's the most important one of the bunch, right? So in Florida, we looked at, Florida had a runoff in three of its statewide races, suggesting that when you ask people partisan questions, they're split 50-50 the way that Florida's been split 50-50 going back, more than 20 years. As we all remember from 2000. But, this Amendment 4 in Florida, which reinstated the right to vote for ex-felons in Florida, is huge. Florida had the most draconian law of anywhere in the country in terms of disenfranchising people convicted of felonies. And as a consequence, we now have 1.4 million new voters, potential million new voters in Florida. To give that some perspective, that's more people than Wyoming and Vermont have together. Another way to think about it is that's 1.4 million people who are theoretically represented in Congress already, but don't have a right to vote. So in terms of their impact on the, apportionment and all these other kinds of things. I don't want to, put my thumb too heavy on this, but I would imagine that if only a small percentage of those people register to vote, and a disproportionate number of them are from traditional Democratic constituencies, so they are immigrants, they are African Americans, they are Hispanics, that's might mean that Florida is no longer a purple state. It might actually be a blue state. So those, I think, are going to be some of the things that are really going to matter in terms of, you know, long-term political ramifications of this election.
So can I add a couple of things to that? I think you're absolutely sure. Right. I also think let's not forget that the Democrats picked up more than 300 seats in state legislatures and 7 state houses in terms, yes, of the governorships changed hands. And those kind of changes matter in terms of apportionment and district redistricting and so on as well. So I think those need to be added to the mix as well in terms of your comment. But I think that strengthens your case about the kind of longer term consequences of this.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, I think when you look at the top line stuff, what's happening in Washington, I think that tells one story. But once you dig down to what's going on, and especially at these, you know, state legislature races and these referendums, I think that there's the Democratic message, or at least the issues, if not necessarily the candidates, seem to suggest that Americans are open to a more liberal slate of agenda, at least at this particular moment, than some of the bigger races may indicate.
Okay, hold on. Let me be a little bit of a downer here. I'm going to be the depressing one now.
No,
you know, we still have the fact that the Senate is the Senate. Hmm. Now, again, I don't think the fact that the Democrats it looks like they've lost one or two seats in the Senate. I don't think that matters so much as the existence of the Senate itself. Hmm. So the map in 2020 is slightly better for Democrats. So maybe they'll make up lost ground in the Senate in 2 years' time. But the fact remains, and you know this. The population statistic you alluded to a second ago about, I think it was Wyoming and Vermont, is telling. The Senate and the way the Senate operates, especially under Mitch McConnell, remains a Republican stronghold because it disproportionately favors rural states, especially rural states that are predominantly white. Mm. And that's unlikely to change anytime soon. So while Democrats may have made gains in state legislatures and in Congress, and that may act as a check on President Trump, he still has this pretty substantial asset in the Senate. Mm. And in the judiciary, of course.
And of course, and just to sort of follow up on that, I mean, I think that means that Republicans will be, you know, retain control of judicial appointments for the next 2 years with little to nothing the Democrats can do about it. So Trump's success in appointing people to the bench that are sympathetic with his worldview, I think that's going to continue unabated.
When I was at this, I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago in Australia, and a colleague...
As one does.
And a colleague from a very who I won't name, but from a very prominent U.S. institution, gave a very interesting paper where he basically said, you know, looking at the history of the United States and its development over the past, he took a kind of broad view like Jill Lepore does in her book, These Truths. Mm. His argument was that the United States, under the Constitution as it presently operates, is basically ungovernable because of the Senate. Hmm. And he called for a new Constitution. Now, I don't believe that's going to happen, which is why I'm not naming him. And in fact, I think it's probably impossible because rural states will not give up the small states, particularly rural states, will not give up the power, the disproportionate power they have. But his argument, I think, and his diagnosis was not far from the truth in the sense that at the moment, the United States seems to be ungovernable. Would you go that far?
It does seem like the structures of government that we have make effective and responsive governing very difficult. You know, there was an article that came out in the New York Times, or an editorial, I guess, not long after the election, that made the argument that we should dramatically increase the size of the House to make it more accurately representative of the population than it is. That the size of the House right now at 435 members is you know, not the kind of democratic institution that, you know, the founders envisioned when they crafted the Constitution, nor is it actually in keeping with the House's big legislatures are in other countries. That they make an argument for a country of our size, there should be at least 700 people in the House, and that would allow for more democratic processes. So I think the fact that people are asking these questions about the, you know, basic fundamental structure of things suggests that I think there is some agreement that the system that we have right now is not functioning well. Which shouldn't be all that surprising. It's a 200-year-old system that hasn't been significantly changed in 200 years. And what was a revolutionary idea about how to structure a government 200 years ago, it shouldn't surprise us that it shows its age.
If I can respond, a couple of things. First of all, I agree about the House, although the House doesn't seem to be as much of a problem as the Senate. A larger House of Representatives would be more democratic with a small d, and would I think be a good thing. The solution for the Senate, it seems to me, and your observation that we're governed by this by institutions that are almost 240 years old is apt. We tend to think of the United States as a new and young country, but it's actually probably got one of the oldest and most rickety constitutional frameworks of any, certainly any of the modern democracies, any contemporary democracies. And this makes it slightly unwieldy. I think we have a fiction. I'm saying this parenthetically. Mm-hmm. I think we have a fiction that we've had this unbroken constitution since 1789, because of course the constitution is remade during your period, during the Civil War and its aftermath. I think essentially we're in the second American Republic or the third Republic, really. But I take your point. It's still a very old mechanism. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the solution for the Senate, though, is more states.
Okay.
So, I think, you know, talk of Northern and Southern California being states, you know, because the founders, if we want to invoke them, and I don't even like that phrase, but, you know, when Jefferson designed a system for the admission of new states to the Union, basically the territorial system that was implemented during the early Republic, there was a belief that states should roughly be comparably sized, not geographically, but in terms of population. So when a new territory had a population of 50,000 people, it could apply for statehood. And I think there was an assumption that states would be roughly the same size. You wouldn't necessarily have a state like California with, I think, 40 million people, and then one like Vermont with fewer than a million. And so one solution to this would be to try and have more states we're not going to abolish all the states. I'm not suggesting that. But if California were two states, they'd at least have four senators representing that area instead of two. Yeah. I think the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, I think if we had more states, we'd have more senators, and that would probably be one way to improve the system. It would make the Senate look more like America.
I mean, one way to think about the Senate is the Senate is a long-term permanent gerrymander established by people in the 19th century to pursue their short-term political interests. And I don't see reason why we should be hamstrung by that. Why is there a North and South Dakota when there really only should be one Dakota? Well, it's because Republicans in the late 19th century wanted to get an extra two senators. They decided to split it in half. People in the Dakotas probably don't want to hear that, but that's sort of the political reason why those two states exist as distinct entities, you know, and the fact that they have four senators and California has two, you know, it doesn't, if for people who believe in that democracy should at least play some role, and so the idea that the majority of people want should have some impact about who's governing them, the whole structure of the Senate and the Electoral College to a lesser extent, you know, doesn't really make a huge amount of sense, and really is hard to justify.
Oh, but David, it's the cooler. It's the saucer that cools the tea and all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense, and you actually look at it in practice anymore. And the Senate may have done that at certain points in time, but it hasn't done that recently. It's now a situation where 30% of the population of the country gets to make decisions for, the other 70%, whether they like it or not, in terms of appointing judges, in terms of, all kinds of things. And so it's not, providing oversight of other government agencies and what have you. So it's I think, a really increasingly harder to justify this whole system, especially as the populations of the large states become increasingly large and the populations of the small states shrink or maintain. North Dakota, for instance, and I'm not sure why I'm beating up on North Dakota, but I used to live in North Dakota. Population of North Dakota has remained the same since the Great Depression. The population of California has not. And, the fact that they each get two senators doesn't really reflect, the sort of reality of things. It's getting absurd on some level. So, the question is then, if the system is broken, what are the tools for actually remedying it? And there our options are profoundly limited because the structure of powers are such that people in power like to stay in power. So unless you have a new constitutional convention and want to open up that can of worms, which occasionally you hear people say maybe we should do that, who knows what we'll end up with then. It could be worse. So we will see.
In terms of looking at the midterm results, if we can go back to that, David.
Yes, but instead of having a new constitutional convention, yes. Restructuring the entire American government. Okay, yes.
Back to the midterms. Actually, looking forward to 2020, because, of course, the presidential election began the day after the midterms on Wednesday 2 weeks ago. Did anybody emerge? I mean, it's interesting because the stars going in, Beto O'Rourke, Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum, were all defeated. Although one of the analogies, one of the comparisons I've made, and I think I'd be interested to hear your views on this.
Everyone's made is Lincoln.
I know. Right? Yeah, is Lincoln. So, and of course that was followed by a civil war. But sorry, just in case not all of our listeners are familiar, of course, Lincoln lost in a high-profile Senate race in 1858 and ran for president successfully in 1860. Is that an appropriate comparison for Beto O'Rourke?
I think you can. That's the example you bring out anytime that somebody who you want to win doesn't win and narrowly loses, and you say there's hope for them in the future. The thing about Lincoln's losing that election is actually Lincoln may have gotten more votes in that election than Stephen Douglas, but of course in the 19th century, state legislatures selected U.S. senators, not the voters. And so the reason why Douglas won, that has to more to do with the gerrymandering within the Illinois legislature than anything else. I think among the people who could be considered for either the first seat or the second seat in 2020 include, Beto O'Rourke, Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum. I think they would all potentially bring something to the ticket, whether they have enough, I was about to say have enough experience, but then I realized that's no longer a criteria for these kinds of things. They could definitely, but would definitely add something to the, especially the VP slot if they want to be considered for that. I think it's wide out in the open who could run. I think, in some senses you're right, the race does start the day after the midterm ends, but trying to figure out who the front runners are and who's likely to end up as the nominee, I think it's far too soon to say anything. No one's actually thrown their hat in the ring officially yet anyway, although lots of people are making trips to Iowa, which is a wonderful destination tourist spot, but is somewhat suspicious.
Including Beto.
Yes. Well, who doesn't want to go to Iowa? I mean, it's nice. They got stuff.
They've got stuff. There's the Iowa Tourist Board. That's their slogan. Iowa,
well,
we've got stuff.
Well, I was thinking, like, I was trying to think of when the state fair was, but that's already happened. So it's clearly not the state fair. I'm sure they've got good turkeys there. So maybe Thanksgiving in Iowa.
Well, undoubtedly we will return to the 2020 race, so we don't really need to belabor it here.
Yes. Okay.
It might come up again.
Well, the other thing that I think is worth thinking about with this midterm, just before we move on to talk about Jill Lepore, is, you know, the Democrats did pretty well in the House, but those people don't take office until January. And so we still actually have a lame duck session in which Republicans contain control of both houses of Congress, and which I would not be surprised if they try to get something passed in that window. You know, the importance of the lame duck session has grown over the past five or six Congresses, and you know, they clearly have to deal with the farm bill, but I wouldn't be surprised if they also try to get wall funding passed during the lame duck session. And so, you know, even if the Democrats did very well in the election itself, we're not actually going to have Democrats in power in the House until January. So, you know, the story isn't over yet with that transition.
No, it's not. No, it's not. So we've got to. What do you think of President Trump's response to all of this? It's been more erratic than ever, I think.
I would concur. Where he tried to claim that the election was a mandate in support of his leadership, and that the Republicans did very well, which didn't seem to comport with the actual results. One thing we've talked about in the past, and I think it was evident after this election, is the ways in which sort of the mechanics of elections and claims about voter fraud and all these things have really played out, especially in Georgia. Or Kemp, the guy who won the governor's race, you know, was also simultaneously the Secretary of State and therefore responsible for overseeing the election and the ways in which that may have influence the result. I mean, it clearly influenced the result somehow. Whether it would have actually changed the outcome is hard to say. But I think we may hear more of those kinds of stories in the years to come, both about actual voter fraud disenfranchisement and claims about voter fraud of various kinds.
Yes, so we have a lot to keep an eye on in the next couple of years, I think.
All right, let's talk about Jill Lepore. I imagine many of our listeners know who Jill Lepore is, but for those who don't, or for those who only have had a limited exposure to her, Frank, do you want to give a précis of her academic career so that people know who we're talking about?
Sure. Jill Lepore is a professor at Harvard, a history professor of American history at Harvard, and a staff writer, I think, at The New Yorker. And yes. So she has a kind of unique place. In fact, in the interview in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I think they use the phrase unique perks in American life. So she's a very prolific scholar. She's written a number of books. Her first book was about King Philip's War, which came out 20 years ago. She's written about slave conspiracies in New York. She wrote a book that I think we discussed already in the podcast, The Whites of Their Eyes, which was about the rise of the Tea Party. She wrote that in published that in 2010. And most recently, she's written a novel with Jane Kamensky, who's now at Harvard as well. She wrote a biography of Jane Franklin, who's Benjamin Franklin's wife. And most recently, she's written...
I thought it was Benjamin Franklin's sister.
Oh, you're right. His sister. Sorry. Apologies.
Unless they had a weird relationship.
Franklin... Anyway. No, you're right.
She wrote a book about Wonder Woman, which we talk about in the context of our Wonder Woman. Yeah. So she's a amazingly prolific scholar.
Most recently, this massive one-volume History of the United States, which came out this year, These Truths, History of the United States, which was published by Norton to a great amount of fanfare and attention. It's said to be, and although Lepore herself says she thinks this is true, she's not certain, it's said to be the first one-volume History of the United States written by a woman.
And it's not. No. I can get it's not because one a friend of the podcast is actually the author of the first single-authored solo history. That's redundant. History of the United States. Susan Mary Grant of Newcastle University wrote 5 or 6 years ago. Wrote a single-volume History of the United States. So she's the first woman to write a to do that. But.
Well, and actually, Mercy Otis Warren wrote one in 1805.
Oh, yeah, but she didn't have as much to work with.
No, but she wrote her History of the Revolution.
Yes.
Goes from Columbus down to the Revolution. So
fair point. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, but I wanted to make that a matter of record that Susan Mary had done this beforehand, because I think that's one thing this book has often been credited as. We want to make sure the record is set straight.
But the point is, Jill Lepore is a very prominent, very eminent historian, very prolific writer who's written across the kind of range of American history and culture, and through her essays in The New Yorker has a kind of outsized influence beyond that of many other historians, including our good selves.
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. One of the things, thinking about the trajectory of her career before we get into the interview, I mean, her first two books In the Name of War, you mentioned on King Philip's War, and then her book on the New York Slave Revolt, were in some ways very traditional academic texts.
Yeah, especially David. The book New York Burning was her third book.
Oh, sorry.
Her second book was A is for American, the one about the origins of the Noah Webster and his dictionary.
Fair point. Okay.
Sorry, but I take
but especially her first book is a very, you know, which was her doctoral work, is a very academic book, and I think she made a transition at some point between books, you know, 3 and 4, 4 and 5, who knows? It's hard to keep count. She's clearly a much more prolific scholar than almost anybody else out there. To become a much more public facing historian than one that is, you know, writing for the academy or writing for specialists. You know, she starts off her career as a early Americanist, somebody who specialized in the, you know, the 17th and 18th centuries, and now has been writing about things that take place in the 20th, 19th century, 20th century, you know, everything under the sun, as this new book suggests. And writing for The New Yorker, I think, is a large part of that. And she also appears on NPR fairly regularly. She's a regular guest or a semi-regular guest on Terry Gross's Fresh Air, where Terry Gross always introduces her as a New Yorker writer and then mentions she also teaches at Harvard, which I think is putting the cart before the horse. But nonetheless, it's sort of like introducing Joe DiMaggio as the guy who sells coffee makers and also occasionally plays baseball. But she is a really extraordinarily prominent historian who has cultivated this much, you know, bigger public audience because of her work with The New Yorker in particular. All of which I think is to sort of contextualize this interview that she has in the Chronicle of Higher Education, where she says how should we put this? She makes some very pointed comments about academic history more broadly. Do you want to summarize some of the
things
that jumped out at you?
Sure. I mean, she said three things that jumped out at me and that certainly our colleagues on Twitter and social media have highlighted since the interview appeared. And it's fair to say she's received a considerable amount of criticism from our colleagues in the past couple of weeks. So the three things were, the first, essentially she said, we have we as historians have turned our back on the public. We no longer engage the public. And the comparison which the interviewer made and which I think Lepore is conscious of is the kind of great historian of the middle of the 20th century, Richard Hofstadter, who was both a prolific historian but also somebody who engaged – was seen as engaging with the public. And I think Lepore perhaps sees herself as writing in that kind of – as inhabiting that space as a public intellectual. And she's more or less said the rest of us who don't have the benefit of working for the New Yorker and don't have access to that kind of venue have turned our backs on the public. And she implies in the interview that this is a result of the kind of splintering of the profession in the 1960s because of the new social history and the attention to different groups. So we've lost our kind of coherence is we've lost our kind of narrative coherence when it comes to the approach in the American past, and this has been left to what she disdains as presidential historians, which are journalists who write histories of presidencies. So that was one point. The second point she made, which I think was has generated some controversy, is that our language is so abstruse that we've alienated the public. So we've turned away from the public, and we write in such a fashion that we make ourselves inaccessible to the public. And her third point, which I think also attracted attention, but there's a lot more validity to it. And she observed this as a prominent female historian, is that women have to try much harder to achieve, to win academic accolades and credibility than men do. That it's sort of the default position for male academics is authority, whereas women have to work much harder to achieve their authority as scholars. I think we can actually, to some extent, the third point might be her biggest point, but is also the least controversial because I think it's true.
I think
the first two are much more contentious from the standpoint of ourselves as practitioners of history. I think the third point speaks to the broader culture. I actually think her third point is true. You know, whether she's the first or the third woman to write a single volume history of the United States, there are lots of men who've done it and haven't necessarily done it as well as she has. Have you read These Truths yet?
I have not. It came out in the middle of the semester, and so we are speaking from ignorance about the text itself. Although, you know, I've heard it's pretty good. I've heard she makes some factual mistakes about Indian removal. But I haven't had a chance to.
I've only read the reviews thus far. But I mean, I think in factual mistakes in a book of that scale and scope are almost inevitable. There's been some pushback that she doesn't have enough indigenous history, and her perspective is very much that of the East in the book, whereas she's neglected the Western parts of the United States, particularly during the colonial period. But maybe we'll talk about the book at another time. But I think her third point of criticism, or the third point that generated discussion in the interview, that, with regard to the authority of women historians, is demonstrably true and unfortunate. Yeah. So I'm not sure we should.
Yeah, no, I think she's right about that. But the other two issues, the points that I think she makes, I think she's just fundamentally wrong about. And I'll just read here. So the second point you mentioned about the way that academic historians write. This is what she says in the interview. She said, like any PhD program, what you're being trained to do is employ a jargon that instantiates your authority in the obtuseness of your prose, which in and of itself is kind of a jargony sentence. You display what you know by writing in a way that other people can't understand. That's not how I understand writing. Writing is about sharing what you know in a storybook clarity, even and especially if you're writing about something that's complicated or morally ambiguous.
So hold on. Can I jump in there? First of all, storybook clarity is not the writing I associate with the New Yorker. Secondly, that sentence which you said, the sentence you read, which a lot of people fixated on and said, are you kidding me? Do you think she was trolling us? Because there are
I think she was, but yes.
Basically,
I don't know what half of those words means.
Using the kind of language that she's accusing historians of using.
I mean, the question I have is I don't know anybody who was trained specifically to write in that, write in a way that is inaccessible, and which is the fundamental claim that she makes, that you're trained to write to be part of a club, and that it's supposed to be so dense, and this is kind of the reputation that academic historians get, is that we, you know, don't write in a way that's accessible to a general public. And I don't know of any PhD program that does that by its design. Now, that may have been true when she was going to Yale in the, you know, early 90s. You know, and I think there was a point with postmodernism where that may have been true in some particular programs. But that wasn't true when I was in graduate school. We were told to write in a way that, you know, your grandmother can read it, even if she doesn't have any training in history. And I, you know, imagine you were trained in a similar kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, Lepore and I are exact contemporaries because, we were in the same class at Tufts.
Oh, really?
As undergraduates. But
did you know her?
I did not, which is interesting because it was a very small place. I mean, I would recognize her, but I did not know her, so I can't. Oh, okay. I can't reflect on that. But what I'm saying is, academically and intellectually, we are contemporaries. And certainly when I went to graduate school and was trained by Alan Taylor, clarity of prose was all important. So I agree with you that, you know, I think she set up a straw man or a straw person there. I just don't believe that to be true. And I think there's a kind of – she disdains popular history in that interview. So she's kept her academic bona fides, and she disdains, you know, journalists of the McCulloch Meacham School, as she calls them, who write, again, what she calls presidential history. Yet she's accusing academic historians, and this is the criticism that's always made of academic historians by comparison with so-called popular historians, is that we academic historians don't write well, we don't write with clarity, etc. So she's kind of having it both ways, it seems to me. She's on the side of the popular historians, but she's saying, well, I don't do what they do. I write kind of serious history, but I do it in an accessible way, unlike everybody else. So she seems to have set herself apart as a kind of singular person in this, and I just don't think that's true.
Yeah, I don't. Because I know the best academic historians are the ones who are the best writers in many cases, the ones who write in a way that is accessible to non-specialists. To be sure, there's a place in academic history for people who write very much inside the box for a very particular audience kind of history. But, you know, there are more historians than ever, I think, in academia who are interested in writing for a general public than I think has ever been the case. And so I'm not quite sure where she's getting these ideas that PhD programs produce bad writing, because I don't think that's – or produce, you know, particularly jargony writing. At least that's not been my experience. I don't think it's – the experience more broadly. That may be the experience at Yale when she was doing her PhD, and that may be the experience at Harvard, but I don't think that's the case, you know, across academia more broadly.
I'm not even sure it's the case at Yale when she was there, in the sense, you know, she was trained by John Demos, and Demos, particularly in the latter part of his career, was all about storytelling. I mean,
John Demos, I don't believe, actually has a PhD.
Right. Interesting. I didn't realize
I think he was one of those people who came in who didn't have who had publications but didn't have a PhD in a time when you could do that. So, I mean, she does in the interview say, like, actually at Yale, I worked with a bunch of people who wrote really well, and somehow I ended up writing really well, but the training was to not write really well. So it doesn't actually logically follow. The other point that you mentioned that I think we need to talk about is she sort of claims that academic historians have given up on engaging with the public, you know, and she says that not enough academic historians speak to a general audience. And I also think that I think she was just fundamentally wrong about that.
Well, crucially, she's not on Twitter because you and I are, and Twitter is full of really smart historians engaging with the public. Kevin Cruz
yes.
being a case in point, but you know, Seth Kotler. There's a long list of Joanne Freeman, Annette Gordon Reed. There's a long list.
Karen Cox. Yep. Just hundreds of brilliant historians who are on Twitter, and then there's the rest of us too. And the difference about things like Twitter versus writing for the New Yorker is a one-way communication. You know, she is communicating with the public, but the public isn't communicating with her. Whereas there are lots of historians, Twitter is one vehicle, but it's not the only vehicle. They are actually engaging with the public, where they're responding to questions and having conversations, debates with actual non-historian people, which are out there, believe it or not. So it's interesting that she's not there. She's not in that kind of public space. She's a public historian, you know, in the way that she talks about it, in a very kind of traditional model in an interesting way. So, I mean, for somebody writing in 2018, the way she's engaging with the public by writing for the New Yorker, that's a very 1950s era model of way of engaging with the public.
Yes, it's a Richard Hofstadter-style public intellectual, which she writes for a prominent magazine. I can tell you, because my daughter wanted the cover of the most recent issue of The New Yorker that has the it's a striking cover of women entering Congress, and all the men in Congress are in black and white, and the women are in vivid color. And my daughter wanted this to frame. I struggled to find that in New York, among other places. So The New Yorker is, The New Yorker is not necessarily the most popular venue to write in. So this is a woman who teaches at Harvard and writes for The New Yorker. And you're right, Terry Gross is impressed by that. I love The New Yorker, but The New Yorker is not a mass market publication necessarily. So her perspective, as you say, is it's very middle of the 20th century in terms of the kind of venue she's using to exercise her power as a public historian.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important publication if you're living on the Upper East Side and are going to the right cocktail parties.
Right.
But it's not something, and it's something that lots of people subscribe to and then don't honestly read.
It's a hell of a lot of reading, The New Yorker.
Well, my subscription lapsed a long time ago. In some ways, she is trying to engage in the public in a very, very old-fashioned kind of way. She's not appearing, she does do these occasional radio things, but she doesn't appear on television much. She's not online in the way that lots of historians are online. So I'm sort of baffled by that part of the interview, because it takes a very limited vision of what public engagement is. And
some historians
I get the impression,
have podcasts.
I've heard tell that this is the case. And I guess the point I'm trying to make, and I think we're both on the same page on this, is that there's lots of ways to engage with the public besides having being a columnist for The New Yorker, and ways that don't require a annual subscription, and ways that can get to a much broader global diverse audience that she doesn't seem to recognize exists. And that may tell us more about her than it does about historians' engagement with the public. Because I think academic historians are more interested in engaging with the public now than they ever have been. And we have more opportunities to engage with the public now than we ever could in the past. Back in the 50s, Hofstadter could write articles for mainstream publications and therefore get to a mass audience. Now, any two idiots who want to have a podcast who are academics can do that, as we've demonstrated.
Week after week.
Exactly. granted, our audience is difference in both size and demographics than the New Yorker, and that's okay. But I think they're we get this rhetoric though coming from people like Jill Lepore, and I'm not quite sure that's a fair characterization, but we had a conversation 30 or 40 episodes ago when we were looking at Gordon Wood and Joe Ellis, where they were making similar kinds of points about academic historians not engaging with the public, and I think they're just not looking in the right places.
No, I mean, here's a case in point. Joanne Freeman at Yale. Joanne has written a book, Field of Blood, which is about violence in Congress. It came out a couple of months ago. It's received a huge amount of press attention. Joanne is very active on Twitter. And notably, I mean, I would recommend you follow Joanne on Twitter if you don't. But notably, she engages with the public all the time on Twitter. She responds to comments. She responds to public questions. She's got a podcast, a very popular podcast, Backstory, which we've mentioned in other contexts. Mm. I think Joanne, to some extent, is a model of the kind of public engagement. She's very successful at it because she's a very successful historian. But she's more typical, I think, than Jill Lepore recognizes. And Joanne Freeman probably has – I would argue engages more with the public than Jill Lepore does.
I would tend to agree.
I don't know how you measure that, but I kind of intuitively feel that.
Well, she's in the Hamilton program and Jill Lepore is not.
So, yes.
cultural impact measured in different ways. All right. So anything else you want to say about the Jill Lepore article?
Well, no. I mean, I don't want to kind of beat her up too much because as we began this, you know, she's a very, very prolific and important historian. I just think she got this wrong, frankly. I just don't think she understands. I think, you know, I think seen from Harvard Yard and the pages of the New Yorker, the world looks a particular way, but I don't think she recognizes the wider world of academic and scholarly activity. And maybe she's so prolific because she ignores it. I don't know.
that may be the lesson to learn from all this is we all need to just ignore everything else and get more writing done.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, it doesn't detract from her scholarship in any way.
Oh no, I have always admired her scholarship. Since I first encountered it in graduate school and have been amazed at her productivity and at the quality of her, not only sort of the amount, but also the quality of her prose and her ability to range into different topics. I've always been deeply impressed by that. Right. Well, maybe we will return to talk more, because I think some of these issues are going to be reoccurring issues about how historians engage with the public, because I think we're at a point which there seems to be a running debate about how and why historians should engage with the public and what role historians have in the national discourse. Right. Time for last drops, Frank. What do you got?
Right. Well, I'm going to refer back to Twitter, and I have to apologize because I don't have it before me, so I can't remember who sent the original tweet. But if we can put that on the show page, we should.
I'll find that and put it on the show notes. Great.
There was something that went around on Twitter last week, which I'm sure you probably saw, David, which was just amazing. A Japanese university digitized a 19th century, I think of 1861, history of the American Revolution written and published in Japan. Now, of course, Japan's encounter with the United States only began a few years before that. And this book is crazy. You have to see it for the images. And so what you have is, you know, George Washington is portrayed as a samurai warrior. he's fighting dragons and lions and all kinds of different fanciful beasts. His wife, Carol, figures prominently, not Martha, but his wife, Carol.
Carol, okay.
His
little-known second wife.
Yeah. Okay, good. Did you see this thing when it went around?
I've seen it, yes.
And John Adams is carrying a kind of handheld cannon at one point and fighting with Washington, not fighting against him, fighting alongside him. It is I mean, I thought, well, I'm writing a book about Washington right now, and I thought I've got to kind of work some of this into this. It is well worth your time and attention if you haven't already seen it, because it's a little crazy, but it's very, very entertaining in terms of Japan's first encounter with the American Revolution and how this was imagined. And whoever digitized this and made it available, it is a work of genius. So that's my last drop. What about you, David?
I'm going to endorse two things.
You always have two drops.
Sorry, there's too much good stuff going on. One of the courses I'm teaching this semester is our Themes in American Historiography class, which is a class that we have for a master's degree that we run on American history. It's a required core course. One of the choices I made this year in picking the reading list is I wanted to demonstrate to master students that you could be an academic historian and still write persuasively and powerfully for a public audience. So I tried to pick books that were recent books that had demonstrated that you can be a scholar and a public-facing historian at the same time. The book we're reading for the last week of class is a book I really want to recommend to people if they haven't read it already. Heather Ann Thompson's Blood in the Water, which is about the Attica prison uprising in 1971. It's an extraordinary book. I mean, it won the Pulitzer Prize last year for a very good reason. And it's one of the things I think is wonderful about it. It's paced in a very different way than most historians write. You know, that one of the ways you can see this is that often the chapters are 2 to 3 pages long, so it sort of reads like a Stephen King novel rather than like a monograph, the way it's usually structured. So it's really even though it's a 500 something page book, it reads very quickly, but it has, you know, really robust scholarly underpinnings to it. So I'm looking forward to discussing that with our master students next week. It's a really, really great book. And the other thing I want to endorse is a new website, Civil War Image Sleuth, Civil War Photo Sleuth. Oh, my mistake. This is a website that's produced by a computer scientist mainly at Virginia Tech, who became interested in Civil War photography and then came across this problem that we have lots of Civil War photos where we have the photo, but we don't have an attribution of who the photo is of. And so he built a website where you can submit Civil War photos and it can try to match it with other Civil War photos to see if you can figure out who these pictures are actually of. And so it's about sort of photo identification. And one of the consultants in this Civil War Photos project is a historian by the name, I believe his name is Paul Quigley. Frank, does that name ring a bell?
P. Quig, of course. He was your predecessor at the University of Edinburgh. He's a dear friend of the pod, even though he probably doesn't listen.
Well, and he also was a graduate school classmate of mine, so we have a complex career history together. But Paul was one of the contributors to this Civil War photo sleuth website. So if you've got some old 19th century photos at home and you have no idea who the hell it is, you can put it in here and they can try to match it up with other photos from the time period and see if you can get some identification on things.
Excellent.
Great. So it's crowdsourcing and history and all kinds of public facing awesomeness and photos, if you're interested in 19th century photos like I am. Great. Till next time, Frank.
Okay, David. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.